Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
We're going to be looking at the experience of the crossing of the Red Sea. It begins in your Bible in Exodus chapter 13, verse 17, through the end of 15. Notice, if you would, the geographical locations that are mentioned in the last few verses of chapter 13. Now, it came about when Pharaoh had let the people go that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines. Well, this is an anachronism because the Philistines weren't there yet. The Philistines came from the island of Crete. They tried to invade Egypt around 1200 B.C. and couldn't do that and settled on the southern coastline of Palestine. So they're not there yet. But the reason God didn't take them that shortest way, which would be right up the Nile River and then along the coast into Palestine, is because Egypt had numerous fortifications there, because that was the easiest and really only way to come into Egypt without going to the desert, which was extremely difficult. So God took them a different way from the shortest way, and we're going to see why. Even though it was near, for God said, lest the people change their minds when they see war. They would obviously have to fight their way out. These were a slave people. They'd been trapped for years and years and years now. They had no military training. They still had a very subservient attitude. And God was afraid they would turn back. I think it says something of man's free choice in the midst of God's will for his life, that God's going to protect them from becoming discouraged and turning back. And we're going to see that even with God's protection and provision, these people came so discouraged and wanted to go back to Egypt numerous times. Now, notice it says, hence God led the people around by the way of the wilderness to the... Now, you have Red Sea. The term in Hebrew is Yam Suf or Reed Sea. There has been great discussion about exactly what body of water these Israelites crossed. Depending on what theory you hold, whether up north, the marshes close to the Mediterranean Sea, or somewhere in the middle, the Bitter Lakes, or what is known today as the Red Sea, maybe the top of that, depending on which one of those theories you have, is where you put these cities. We do not know where all of these cities are. I think probably the best one is Baal Zephon, and we're not 100% sure of that, but the rest of them, we're not certain at all, and so it's very dubious. But I think the Reed Sea, a little bit later on down here, we're going to find a Hebrew name in chapter 14, verse 2, that means salt marshes. So to me, the center area in the area of the Bitter Lakes is probably where they crossed. Now, and Moses took the bones of Joseph. Remember, Joseph asked that when they left, they take his bones with them. You might want to see Genesis 50, verses 24 and 25. Joseph was mummified, and they're going to take him with him to bury him in the promised land. For he had made the sons of Israel swear, saying, God shall surely take care of you, and you shall carry my bones here with you. Then they set out for Succoth. Now, on your maps, you see Succoth, but we are not certain where it is. It depends on what route you want to take of where you put that. And encamped at Ethon on the edge of the wilderness. And the Lord was going before them in a pillar of cloud. Now, this is the word Shekinah. The rabbis made this up. It's from the root to dwell. And it's the ideal of God dwelling with his people. We think it was the symbolic presence of God with the people of Israel from this time until the crossing of the Jordan River. After the crossing of the Jordan River, it becomes the Ark of the Covenant as the symbol of the presence of God. And the only time I think it appears after that is in Solomon's dedication of his temple. Although when Isaiah saw the Lord high and lifted up and the smoke filled the temple, it's the same idea. This idea of a cloud of glory that represents the presence of God is found throughout the Scriptures. I think not only of coming down the tabernacle and here in the Exodus experience, but I kind of think in the New Testament, the cloud that overshadowed the group there when Jesus was baptized and God spoke out of it. The cloud that overshadowed the Mount of Transfiguration, God spoke out of it. The cloud that took Jesus from the Mount of Olives at his ascension, and the cloud that's promised to return when Jesus returns. Now, this is an exciting cloud, the presence of deity. Now, notice where it says, by day, and led them on the way in a pillar of fire by night. In the daytime, it was a covering to keep them being sunburned. At night, it was a fire to light up the camp. And he did not take away the pillar of cloud by day, nor the pillar of cloud by night, from before the people. Now, chapter 14. Now the Lord spoke to Moses saying, tell the sons of Israel to turn back. Now if you look at some of the maps that try to show us where these are, they were kind of wandering aimlessly, it's going to say, back and forth, back and forth. And God put them in exactly the geographical place where Pharaoh thought, I've got them now. They're trapped against the sea, against the desert. I'll get those slaves back. But God put them there to show them His power, His love, and His provision, as well as to show the Egyptians that He was truly God. I think God's whole attempt at working with the Egyptians, taking all that time to go through the plagues and all those months of interaction with Moses, every one of those plagues seems to affect an Egyptian deity. I think God was trying to witness to the Egyptians as well as deliver the Israelites. Now, and they camped before Pi-Haroth, which means the region of the salt marches, between Migdol, which means the watchtower, and the sea, and you camp in front of Baal-Siphon, which means Baal of the north, which shows the Canaanite fertility religion had really permeated northern Egypt, and that's what's really going to be the plague to the children of Israel. Opposite by the sea. Now, by the sea would determine what body of water we think they crossed, okay? For Pharaoh will say to the sons of Israel, they are wandering aimlessly. This is the idea of confused. He's obviously had spies out there watching them. And they seem to be going back and forth, and he's going to take the advantage of it. And then it says here, verse 4, then I will harden Pharaoh's heart. I discuss this quite often, this idea of hardening. Several times through this experience it said God hardens Pharaoh's heart. Several times it says Pharaoh hardens his own heart, and one time it says Pharaoh's heart is hardened and doesn't say who did it. I believe in predestination and foreknowledge. I also believe in free will. So I think what we have here is the same ideal as Judas Iscariot. God knew what Judas would do, but God did not force Judas to do it. God acts on the basis of what He knows men will do, and yet man is still responsible. Now that is true in the areas like Pharaoh and Judas. That is not true in the area of personal salvation, for God does not choose us because we will someday choose Him. Salvation is totally apart from grace, not because of man's actions or works. And so it's true with unbelievers, but untrue in the form of believers. Now, I've done a tape called Predestination and Free Will. I'd love for you to send for that. And He will chase after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army, and the Egyptians will know that I'm the Lord, and they did so. Now, you might see verse 18, where it also again talks about the Egyptians will know. I believe God is working in a way to bring enlightenment and truth to the Egyptian people. I think that's so true. Then the king of Egypt, we normally call him Pharaoh, was told the people had fled. Pharaoh and his servants had a change of heart toward the people. My goodness, that was a drastic change of heart. He lost his own son. But notice how what a devastating this would be to their agriculture, to their economy. They had these slaves for decades, and now they're going to be gone. Well, it was a drastic monetary problem, economic problem, agricultural problem, building problem. It was going to devastate their society. Pharaoh had a change of heart. So he's going to get these chariots ready. No, it says, and he made his chariot ready, and he took his people with him, and he took 600 select chariots. That's quite a few chariots to have. There's been some fight over the number. Chariots at this time were not used for war. They weren't converted yet. The Hittites were the first to use them for war. The Hittites were the first to use a three-man chariot. We think these are three-man chariots mentioned here. We're not 100% certain. These chariots here would be more for fast mobility than warring instruments themselves. Now, we think these are made a semicircular of wood, two large wheels with a rope meshed bottom, probably two horses. There were three men. There was the captain of the chariot, there was the driver, and there was the warrior. Now, we get that from Hittite documents, not from Egyptian, but we think that's probably true. And so these chariots were rapidly moving troops, and that seems to be the idea here. Notice it says in verse 7, and all the chariots of Egypt with officers, that seems to be the third man, the director, the officer involved over them. And the Lord hardened Pharaoh's heart, king of Egypt, and he chased after the sons of Israel as the sons of Egypt were going out boldly here. Means with a high hand, with joy. They were going out purposefully. That would be a better way to put it. Then the Egyptians chased them with all their horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army. I think that's still, we're talking about the whole group describes the chariot armada, okay? They overtook them camping by the sea. Don't you know those slaves who'd been just free were there taking a bath, enjoying that water, playing around with the kids, and they suddenly saw this dust on the horizon. They said, oh, I wonder if a dust storm's coming. Pharaoh and 600 chariots topped the hill. Friends, you talk about confusion. You talk about mad time of scrambling around. And it's so characteristic of us. They were afraid. Circumstances overwhelmed them. They thought God had abandoned them, and immediately attacked Moses. Poor Moses. He's getting beat over the head for something he didn't even have anything to do with. You brought us out here to kill us, boy, Moses. And this happens throughout the experience. God's bringing them from a slave nation to his people. It took a lot of time. He's going to be patient with them. But here they are, griping, frightened, cried out to the Lord. When that didn't work, they cried out to Moses. Verses 10 and 11. Let's see. Let me go down to verse 13. And Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord. And the word salvation is from the root word for victory. And basically it means to be spacious, to be in a large area. It's the idea here of physical deliverance. Only in the New Testament does it have the concept of spiritual deliverance. Okay? Now, verse 15. Then the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying out to me? Moses dropped down on his knees and started praying. I love this text. I get so tickled here. Here is all these chariots coming, and Moses falls down and prays. And God, there's a time to pray and a time to get on with it. And God says, Moses, this ain't no time to pray. I've already told you I'm going to bring you out. I already told you I'm going to do something. Now stand up and hold that rod over that sea. Isn't that funny? You know, I remember when I first became a pastor, I'd ask folks to help me, and they'd say, oh, Bob, we'll pray about it. And they've been praying now for 10 years, still praying. Friends, I want to tell you, there's a time to pray, and there's a time to get on with the will of God. And God says, Moses, get up and do something, friend. Praying time's over. And so he lifted his staff and stretched it out, hand over the sea, and divided it, and the sons of Israel go through in the midst of the sea. Now, verse 18, the mention again about God working with the Egyptians. Look at verse 19. We have the angel of the Lord and also the pillar of cloud. Now, verse 19 seems to be two different things. The angel of the Lord is one thing and the pillar of the cloud is another. But I really think, theologically, they're probably the same thing. The angel of the Lord here is that personification of God that happens so often. The burning bush, it says the angel of the Lord came up the burning bush and God spoke out of the bush. And there's that dichotomy all the way through here about God being the angel of the Lord, and yet it being God. Now, the pillar of cloud was for two reasons. It separated the army of Egypt from the Israelites, and I also think it probably kept the Israelites from surrendering that night, too. Matter of fact, we're in the middle of the night here, as I'll show you in just a minute. Okay, the angel of the Lord, they moved back behind to separate those two armies. So it came between the camp of Egypt and the camp of Israel, and there was the cloud along with the darkness. Along with the darkness, it was probably darkness to Pharaoh and his men, but light to the children of Israel. And yet gave light at night. And thus the one did not come near the other all night. And Moses stretched out his hand. Now look at verse 21 for me. I want to show you something. Here are three agencies. Moses stretched out his hand. God caused an east wind to blow. Now here we have human instrumentality, the power of God. We've got natural means with supernatural timing. Now, the water walled up on two sides, but it took all night. The east wind piled up one wall. But what about the other wall? Who piled that up? The other thing is the east wind blew all for several hours to dry the bottom out so they could walk across. Now, I saw Cecil B. DeMille's picture, too, where, boy, he does that and boom. But it took all night long. Matter of fact, they're going to leave between 2 a.m. and 6 a.m. Look at verse 24. The morning watch. It was the middle of the night when they walked through that sea. They took all that time for God to do it with natural means. He does many things with natural means, with a supernatural timing and supernatural emphasis. Now, by the way, the Egyptians would have seen God miraculously manipulating the sea as a reference to the creation myth of God handling chaos or the waters of the deep. Now, notice what happened. The waters were like a wall to them on the right and on the left. Boy, it was majestic. Wouldn't you like to have been there? I hope God kept a videotape of this. And the Egyptians pursued them and their horsemen. And it came about in the morning watch. The Lord looked down on the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and the cloud. See, God's in that cloud, not just the angel of the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea. The waters may come back. Moses did it. And the Egyptians were fleeing right into it when the Lord overthrew the Egyptians and missed the sea. Now, this word overthrew, we learn from Jewish literature that this is the same root as the term Shinar, which means Babylon, that's related to the Tower of Babel. And the Jewish rabbis say the same power that split the languages is the same power that overthrew the Egyptians. And I think that's probably true. So all these Egyptians drowned. Some say, well, if it's a marshy deal, the miracle was that God drowned that many Egyptians in just a few inches of water. Well, however he did it, he did it. And notice it says in verse 30 that Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. They floated to the top, and the east wind blew them to the shore. Notice, the Israelites had no armor. They had no swords. They had no spears, no bows. God equipped the Israeli army for their struggles in the wilderness with the bodies of these dead Egyptians that floated to the shore by the east wind. God's provision. Now, notice he went in verse 31. Then Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians. The people feared, or really revered the Lord, and they believed in the Lord and his servant Moses. God is confirming Moses' leadership, and God's confirming his faith in them. Jesus did this same thing many times for the disciples toward the end of his life. He would tell them what was going to happen so that they might believe. Now, they already believed in him. There's a way of encouraging their faith, and that's what God is doing to the Egyptians right here. Now, chapter 14 is a prose section of this account, and chapter 15 is a poetry section of the same account. And here we have a good example of ancient Hebrew poetry. The rhyme is not in sounds, but in thoughts. And it's we have Moses here in 1 through 18, and Miriam in 19, and I think down through, probably through 26, or through 21 anyway. Well, here we have these two songs, and it's poetry. Notice it says, the horse and the rider he has hurled in the sea. This is the idea of chariots, not just Calvary, but the chariots were, their tires bogged down in the soft mud. It was dry enough for the people to walk across, and some carts, but not enough for these heavy chariots. Notice it says in verse 2, they see my salvation. Remember the word salvation and deliverance, the same Hebrew words. It means physical deliverance, okay? Notice in verse 2, my father's God, and I will extol him. Here's the ideal of link to the patriarchal promise of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob again. God as a warrior. This is what the phrase Lord of Hosts means. God is the captain of the armies of heaven. He's called that several times through here, okay? Deuteronomy 1:30, Joshua 5, 13 through 15. 2 Chronicles 20, 29, God as warrior. The Lord is his name. This is the word, see the word all caps in large, the word Yahweh, Y-H-W-H. It was only revealed to Moses in Exodus 3, 14. It's from the Hebrew verb to be. I think it means I am the ever-living, only living one. That's the idea. Okay? Now, notice it mentions the Red Sea here, but really it's the sea of reeds, Yam Suf, where it was, we're not sure. They fell like a rock. Well, I guess they did. They're wearing armor. Thy right hand, in verse 6, the right hand of God is a symbol of power, authority, his action, his, you know, willingness to help. That's the right hand. It's anthropomorphic because God does not have a right hand. Notice in verse 8, the blast of his nostrils, the waters were piled up. Well, this is the theological understanding of the east wind coming at the right time with that kind of intensity to pile those waters up. So there we have, you know, another anthropomorphic phrase. Verse 11 is interesting. Who is like thee among the gods, O Lord? Who is like thee, majestic in holiness, awesome in praises? Now, I believe in monotheism, but apparently it was somewhat of a theological development in Israel. This is what we would call henotheism or monolatry. Israel worshipped only one God while not denying the existence of others. I think there's somewhere around 63 foreign gods listed in the Old Testament. Originally, God was supreme among all gods, but later he was the only true God, and everything else was probably fallen angels or false gods or the demonic. But that developed some. Very soon, though, full-blown monotheism is certainly a part of Israel's faith. Working wonders. This is the God who acts. That's what makes him different from all the other gods. He does something. He acts in history on part of man. The earth swallowed them. This is the idea of Sheol swallowing something up. Verse 13, in loving kindness. This is the special Hebrew verb hesed. As Yahweh is the covenant noun, hesed is the covenant verb. It means no strings attached, covenant loyalty. I personally believe, theologically speaking, it is very similar to the New Testament word agape in its connotations. Thou hast led the people. Here is God as shepherd. You might see Psalms 23. whom thou hast redeemed. This is the word for Goel, which is the kinsman redeemer or the kinsman avenger. You might well see the book of Ruth where Boaz acts that way. It's God as a near kin to purchase us back from slavery. And here it's the physical slavery of Egypt, and also, I think in a real true sense, the spiritual slavery of sin and death. Okay? Verse 14 and 15 talk about how the other nations around were fearful and paralyzed at what God, Israel's God, had done for them. 16, the same thing. Until the people pass over. Now, this could mean Jordan or Canaan. It's obvious that chapter 15 is written long after the 14 is the actual historical account. 15 is written later because it includes the conquest. So I think as Moses had time to reflect, maybe later in this 40-year period, before the children of Israel crossed over the promised land, Moses wrote it down, and Miriam too. Now, notice it says, whom thou hast purchased, the last part of verse 16, there's the idea of redemption again, the Goel. Verse 17, in the mountain of thine inheritance, we found this quite often in the Rosh Shamrah text. Here it refers to Sinai or Horeb. Now, it goes by two names. Some think it's the mountain range of Horeb with Sinai, the particular peak, but we're not really certain there. Let's verse 18, the Lord shall reign over forever and ever. This is the ideal of God as king, which is found throughout the Old Testament. Let me give you a few references. Numbers 33:21, Numbers 24:7, Deuteronomy 33:5, Judges 8:23, Psalms 10:16 and 10:29 are just a few of God as king. That's why Samuel was so hurt when Israel wanted a king, because God was their king. And that's what the whole deal in 1 Samuel about anointing Saul was such a hurtful thing. Notice verse 20, we have Miriam the prophetess. Well, isn't that something? Here is a woman called a prophetess. She's going to speak for God several times. You might want to see Numbers 12:2, Micah 6:4. And not only that, but she's dancing. Woo, wouldn't that cause trouble? A woman preacher dancing. Well, here we have it right here in the Old Testament. Now, the word, let's see. Here's Miriam's song. Miriam's song is a redundant of Moses' song, but I guess she went out and led the women emotional and immediate song of praise with a tambourine. It's kind of an instrument with skin over it. By the way, they wouldn't allow that in the temple. Even then, they wouldn't let certain things. I kind of get tickled when you say, well, you can play this instrument in the church, but not this one. Well, Israel did the same thing. They had certain instruments you could play and certain instruments. So here is Miriam out dancing with the women. And this happens all through the Old Testament. There is some cultic dancers that dance in the temple. But here it's like when the men return from war, the virgins come out to meet them dancing. And so it's a pretty common thing. Now, let's see. Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went out into the wilderness of Shur, and they were there 3 days in the wilderness and found no water. And they came to Marah, which means bitter, and they could not drink the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore, it was named Marah, or Marah. Now we'll see Numbers 33:8. Now here we have another classical experience of human nature. God had just delivered them from this army, killed all the Egyptians, washed all their provisions up to shore, and just a few days later, they're thirsty now. And God brings them to a water, directs Moses, but the water doesn't taste good. It's bitter. And they start griping and griping and griping. First they gripe at God, you let us out here, we're going to just die of thirst. And they gripe at Moses, it's all your fault, you promised us. So God says, Moses, throw this bush in the water. Now here's God using natural means again. What kind of bush it is, I don't know. There's ancient tradition that a certain kind of bush you can throw in has a real strong taste, and it covers up the mineral taste of the waters. I don't know if it's a natural means or a supernatural means, but God used a natural bush to somehow placate these people, let them drink this water. But isn't it just funny? Here they are in God's case. They saw all His miracles in the plagues. They saw all His miracles in crossing the Red Sea, and they're still afraid God's not going to provide. Man, didn't that sound like us? It certainly does. Certainly does. So the people grumbled at Moses, verse 24. Isn't that typical? And he cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. Moses cried at God, and God said, there's a tree. Sound like a sequence I'm familiar with. He threw it in, the waters became good. There he made them a statue and a regulation, and there he tested them. Now this word tested is very interesting. I think God will test all of us. He tested Abraham. He tested the children of Israel. I think Jesus was tested some of the things he had to go through. The early church was tested with persecution. I believe a test will come, but it's a test for strengthening, not a test for destruction. And it will probably come in the area of our individual or corporate priorities. God wants to make sure that we're first, just like He tested Abraham with Isaac. God's going to make sure we love Him. Untested faith may be true faith, but it's not strong faith. And so here God is testing these people. And He said, if you will give earnest heed to the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in His sight and give ear to His commandments and keep His statutes, then I will put none of the diseases on you which I have put on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord your healer. And here's the great promise of God, His protector and healer. And this is probably a precursor thought of Deuteronomy 27 and 28, the cursings and the blessings. If they keep God's law and follow His ways and live in a relationship with Him, that He'll bless them. If they don't, He'll curse them. This is the same idea here. If you follow Me, I won't do to you what I did with the Egyptians. I'll be your sustainer, protector, and healer. And I will tell you, I'm glad God is that kind of a God. You say, well, you believe in healing? Well, you bet I do. I believe in a supernatural God. I don't understand it all. I don't understand how God provides all my needs. I don't understand how God protects me from things I never know would have come. And I don't understand how God heals and doesn't heal. But I'm so glad that we've got a supernatural power for God that acts on our behalf when it's best for us. And yet He tests us to see our attitude, see if we really love Him. Because I think sometimes we're more prone toward loving the gifts than we are the giver. Isn't that the truth? Now, they came to Elim, where there were 12 springs of water and 70 date palms. They camped there beside the waters. Well, that sounds like a lot when you think there's probably 2.5 million folks. I don't know how far 70 date palms will go. But here they were at a cool oasis, and they were satisfied because the waters tasted good and there was something to eat, so they didn't gripe anymore. Well, the children of Israel are a perfect symbol of us as they saw God's power, but just continue to say, what's the matter with you, God? Don't you care? And we got to be careful to keep our eyes off circumstances and on God, because He will always provide our need.